Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, we'll check in on Sunday's runoff election in Brazil.
But first, nurse Nina Pham, who contracted Ebola treating the Dallas patient, who was the first to die from the disease in the U.S., has been declared free of the virus, receiving a big hug from Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIH before leaving. She's been invited to visit the Oval Office this afternoon. In New York, doctors and nurses at Bellevue Hospital are treating Dr. Craig Spencer, the first Ebola patient in Manhattan, who returned 1 week ago from treating Ebola patients in Guinea. Health officials say Dr. Spencer went bowling, took the subway, 1 day before calling Doctors Without Borders, where he volunteered, that's yesterday, to say he had a fever. At a news conference, Mayor Bill de Blasio urged anyone in New York who's been to West Africa in the past 21 days who has a fever or other symptoms to act quickly.
It is crucial to call 911 immediately, or the only other alternative, go immediately to a hospital emergency room. I want to emphasize, those are the only two acceptable actions. Call 911 or go to a hospital emergency room. Do not wait. Do not hesitate. Do not wait to see if you get better. Do not go to a private doctor's office.
Let's check in with Dr. Erwin Redliner, special advisor to Mayor de Blasio and also director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. And, Doctor, we're hearing a lot of officials today say that New York is prepared for any disaster that might ensue. Hazmat crews have been at Dr. Spencer's apartment, but what else do you have to do? You can't clean every subway, and he rode on the subway.
Right. And I think one of the big challenges now, Robin, is to separate what we know from science and public health proven strategies to actually work and be necessary versus sort of on the other end of the spectrum trying to allay a public anxiety, which of course is understandable, about what should be done or what could be done. The fact of the matter is, as has been repeated multiple times, is that people who have had contact and who get Ebola, documented Ebola, are literally not contagious during the incubation period, and they're not contagious via the spread in the air of Ebola virus, because we know now very well that you really need to be in contact directly with the individual with Ebola and directly in contact with their bodily fluids, as we keep hearing. But so what needs to be done now is, I think this is really just a public health education message, that if you have been in a place where there is a prevalence of Ebola, and you especially have been working with Ebola patients, and you get any kind of symptoms, and especially low-grade fever or any kind of fever in the first 21 days after that contact, you are a candidate to be checked out and tracked, if not cared for. So,
well, we're wondering if more should be done than that, because we understand this doctor, who's being lauded as a heroic figure who went and helped people who were dying from this disease, but he began feeling sluggish on Tuesday. And some are saying that some health officials are considering a buddy system, not just as recommended by the CDC for watching people as they take off the protective gear, apparently the most dangerous time when they can infect themselves, but maybe just being in touch with other doctors so that if you start to feel not well, someone else can help point it out to you. In other words, the call could have come in on Tuesday.
Right. Well, I think that, first of all, the symptom of sluggishness or feeling tired is not a major sign. It could be, but it isn't. And, you know, what we're really looking for is the presence of fever, headaches, severe headaches, actually, vomiting, diarrhea, and so forth, and real feelings of malaise. In the absence of that, and with a normal temperature, there's really not much to report. Now, that being said,
right,
I do think there is, in effect, there is a mechanism, because Dr. Spencer and anybody else who's been involved, certainly with Doctors Without Borders, have actually a routine access to and instructions to let that organization know or let public health officials know that they are developing something.
Right. And Amber Vinson, the nurse, said the same thing. She felt sluggish first. One would think that if you know you've been in contact with an Ebola patient, any feeling not well might be reported. But we know this starting Monday, people returning to the U.S. from West Africa will be monitored. They have to self-monitor, take their temperatures. Officials will contact them every day. But Anthony Fauci today mentioned at his news conference with the nurse Nina Pham that there's active discussion about having somebody actually be in touch with people. We just have a couple seconds, but do you think that'd be a good idea? In other words, go visit them, not just ask them.
I think it's a fine idea. He's a doctor with great experience. I think we're feeling pretty good that he knew what to do and was doing it. But I certainly don't think that what you're talking about here with the extra
precaution
would be fine.
Yeah. Dr. Erwin Redlener, special advisor to Mayor de Blasio in New York, where they have the first Ebola case in that city. He's also director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, in other news, Brazilians go to the polls on Sunday to elect their next president in a runoff election. And when I say Brazilians, I mean all Brazilians, or at least nearly all of them. The law in Brazil requires every eligible voter to vote, except members of the military and elderly people. Lourdes Garcia Navarro is NPR's correspondent in Sao Paulo, Brazil. She's been watching the race closely and joins us now. Welcome, Lourdes.
Thank you.
And it looks like President Rousseff has pulled ahead in the polls in the last few days. What are people in Brazil talking about just 2 days before the election?
Yeah, so most of the recent poll numbers are out, and they show incumbent Dilma Rousseff ahead by 6 to 8 points. That's ahead of her competitor, Aécio Neves. They had been neck and neck for a while now, with Neves actually ahead of her at a certain point, but that has reversed itself. And I think this anecdote will tell you why some people have shifted their vote. There's a doorman in a building that my producer spoke to. He used to live in a favela or a shantytown before Rousseff's party, the PT, came to power. He never had a fixed job, he tells us. And now he has a house that was given to him by a government program for housing for the poor. He has a steady job with a better salary because the economy has grown. And he gives credit for all of this to the policies of this government and the one before it, which was run by Rousseff's mentor, Ignacio Lula da Silva. They are all from the same party. And that's what Rousseff's people have been hitting on it. They've been reminding people how much things have changed in the 12 years since the PT has been in power, how much the economy has grown, how better off people are, supposedly.
And yet, right now, Brazil is in recession. Inflation is very high.
That's the thing. There is this script the government here is selling. It's about how great things are. But the reality, as you say, is that the economists are saying that Brazil has slipped into a technical recession. The real's value has plunged. Inflation is a huge problem. But when you speak to people, so many are worried about education and healthcare, and they're very critical of the government on those things. But millions were brought out of poverty during the last 12 years, and people are afraid that they will lose what they have gained, that they will slip down that rung again.
And let's talk about the candidates here. And the one that we don't know as well, that would be Aécio Neves. Tell us about him. And there was a social media frenzy this week when Lindsay Lohan showed support for him.
Yeah. Let's start with Aécio Neves. I mean, he comes from a very fine political pedigree here. He is the grandson of a much beloved politician. He was the governor of one of the largest, most powerful states here, Minas Gerais. So he is a known quantity. And, you know, he comes from a right-of-center party. And that's one of the problems. He has a bit of an image problem of being elitist, only serving the interests of the wealthy. It's no secret here that the markets and big business, and for that matter, the big media companies, all want Aécio Neves to win. And if he does, he's promised a serious change in direction for the country. That means less state intervention, opening up the markets. So a different tact. And yes, as you mentioned, Lindsay Lohan has become a sort of bizarre star in this political season. Brazil is one of the most active places in the world for social media, and it's really gone into overdrive during these elections. And apparently Lindsay Lohan set Twitter on fire because she tweeted an endorsement of Aécio Neves. It was written in this very odd language. It didn't seem like it was written by an actual English speaker. And as it turns out, it was a sort of sponsored tweet that she then had to retract because, of course, it was being made fun of all over social media here. And it was just a pretty funny episode. But we also have Naomi Campbell tweeting in support of Aécio Neves, and it's just become a kind of a bit of a silly season in that sense.
I'm actually surprised that people in Brazil know who Lindsay Lohan is, but I guess she's a big star there.
I guess, you know, people know who Lindsay Lohan is. They definitely follow the American stars. And even though her star has faded, they definitely knew who she was. And they weren't terribly impressed with her endorsement of the candidate. I think it did more harm than good.
And what about President Rousseff? What's the relationship going to be like with the U.S. if she is reelected?
I mean, I think that's certainly one of the big questions right now. If she is reelected, and it looks like she will be, if we look at the most recent polls, they've had a very rocky relationship, certainly after Dilma Rousseff decided not to go on that state visit, if you'll recall, to see President Obama, after it was shown that the NSA had been spying on her and her cabinet.
Right.
So it remains to be seen if, you know, if that relationship can be repaired, if there is even the will here for it to be repaired. And let's not forget, you know, we have an election of our own in 2 years. So Dilma Rousseff, if she is reelected, will be dealing with a new American president, and that might be able to reset the clock. There are more expectations that if Aécio Neves wins, that he would have a much warmer relationship with the United States. He certainly indicated that that would be the case. And I think that would be obviously a welcome development for the United States. Brazil is the sixth largest economy in the world. It is part of the BRICS, so it has very strong relationships with countries like Russia and China. And it is a big player in this region. It gives a lot of support to countries like Venezuela, countries like Cuba, which do not have warm relationships with the United States. So if it changed its leadership, would those foreign policy choices change? What would that mean for Latin America? What would that mean for the world? It's a very important election in that sense.
And BRICS, by the way, for people who don't know, that's some of the emerging economies in the world: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Lourdes, one more thing. There's a drought and water crisis in Brazil right now. Is that playing into the election?
Absolutely. Aécio Neves' party is in control of the governorship of Sao Paulo, where the drought has hit worst. And it's being used as a political baton to beat him with, if you will. It's a really serious problem here, the drought. It's on the front page every single day. We really can't overstate it. There are areas that have seen no water for weeks. People are hoarding water. They're trucking in water. People are digging wells just to get access to water. This is in the financial capital of the country and the largest city in South America. So it's a real crisis.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR's international correspondent, joining us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And again, the election is this Sunday. Lourdes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Not that I have to remind any Brazilians if they're listening, because as we said, they are required by law to vote.
Required by law.
The most we can do here, and by the way, we do have an election coming up a week from Tuesday, is at least tell you that there's an election coming up a week from Tuesday. A lot of people, Robin, aren't even aware of that at this point, although not our listeners.
In other countries, they are required to vote. The FBI is still investigating the case of three teenage girls from Colorado. It's believed tried to join ISIS militants in Syria. Agents stopped the girls, 15, 16, and 17, at the airport in Frankfurt, Germany, over the weekend after their parents reported them and a lot of cash missing. A U.S. official said they were headed to Syria by way of Turkey. A month ago, a 19-year-old woman from Colorado was arrested. She pled guilty to conspiring to help ISIS. And on Wednesday, British police arrested a 25-year-old woman suspected of plotting terrorist acts related to Syria. And there are more. So why are women from the U.S. and Europe joining Islamic militants? Catherine Brown is a professor in the Defense Studies Department at King's College London. She focuses on women in terrorism. And Catherine, we seem to ask this question every few years. We remember the Pennsylvania woman, Jihad Jane. So how big a concern is this in Britain?
It is quite a concern at the moment, but one of the things that is becoming quite apparent is the numbers are actually quite small. So we're looking at probably only about 200 women across the entire of Europe, and from the UK, a maximum of 50 or 60 young women. So it is a concern. The numbers do seem to be increasing, especially with increasing awareness that it's possible to travel to Syria and Iraq. And also as ISIS are putting out a pretty smooth propaganda and media message of their own that seems to be targeting young women.
Well, the friends of the three girls who disappeared in Colorado say that they were talking about their plans on their social media.
Yeah.
There's sometimes a real, you can clearly see the map of their plans. Is it the same in Britain?
It is indeed, yeah. Those women that are involved are often checking online, various websites and everything. But what is interesting is that the friends of those involved tend to be surprised that they actually go ahead and do it.
Even though they have been talking about it.
Yeah, I think some of it is often a sense of adventurism, but everybody talks about it and brags about it, but probably doesn't do it.
Yeah. Well, and why do they do it, those that do? There's there's thinking that it's they're being wooed to be the jihadi brides of men in ISIS, but you say that's only part of the story.
It is only part of the story. I think what's really interesting here is there is a naive romanticism that we see, but it's not just about being wooed to marry Islamic fighters in Iraq and Syria, but it's also about a romanticism about being part of a new political state. This idea of being part of a new community and being taken seriously. Because what we're seeing as well is that ISIS take young people seriously. They take their politics seriously, they give them a voice, they give them credit. And that has a certain amount of appeal in a society, at least over in Europe, where young people are not given the credibility that they might otherwise want.
Well, and women perhaps from certain cultures in particular. The ISIS is letting these women carry Kalashnikovs and have jobs.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. So again, it could be argued, it's not something I feel comfortable arguing, but it could be argued that ISIS are offering a form of empowerment and that they're offering them a sense of adventure, something more than the mundane lives that they would otherwise have.
How does that square, though, with other Islamic organizations? Because we understand that the Islamic fundamentalists want their women covered in the back room. So how does that square?
I would say that various forms of Islam don't necessarily want to hide women away per se, but they definitely want to protect them. But it's squared in the sense that these women are often wearing abayas and they do also predominantly live gender segregated lives. And also because they're fighting jihad. And once you do that, once you step outside the ordinary bounds of politics, then these things become possible.
That's Catherine Brown of King's College London, expert on women in terrorism. You're listening to Here and Now. And perhaps we should say here, as some people are saying and we've reported on, this is not, in their view, the Muslim faith. ISIS is more of a criminal enterprise. But you say these young women in particular really do have a romantic notion of what's going to happen for them. What else do they think?
I think it is a part of that notion of being part of a new politics, being part of a new sisterhood, being able to resist what they see as being oppression and living in the West. And whether that oppression is from the family or whether it's from the state itself or from not feeling that they fit in. So there's part of that. And I would say that the messages that ISIS are putting forward are not mainstream Islamic messages at all. They're not ones that you would find in the mosque. They're not ones that you would find ordinarily spoken. They're definitely radical interpretations. But that also is appealing because it holds a degree of simplicity, because it's able to paint the world in black and white, and that makes it very easy to understand and believe in. Whereas, actually, like with all religions, it's very complex. Islam, like Christianity, has a complex tradition of thinking, very different practices and ways of being Muslim and ways of practicing Islam. And I think what fundamentalism does is it provides the simple black and white model that young people find appealing.
Well, and others would suggest that these young women are also being lied to. Mia Bloom from the Center for Terrorism and Security Studies at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, she argues that these women might be told that they're going to be raised and in esteem and have all the, you know, be jihadi brides, but that in fact they're little more than baby factories. They're just going to pop in.
Yeah, I think she's also referred to it as a jihadi Tupperware party. I would say that that might have been the case at the very beginning, but the now, actually, there's quite a bit of awareness about what women are doing in Iraq and Syria, the variety of roles that they have. And there's also an awareness of the hardships that they'll face. You know, they don't have electricity all the time. They have to share toilets, a communal loos. It's not an easy lifestyle that they're about to adopt. And that's well known now. So I think the messaging has changed slightly. And instead, they're being sold a line that is essentially saying, you know, give up your material wealth and easy life and do something worthwhile.
Oh.
But I agree, I don't think when they get there, it is anything quite as romantic or as idealistic or as inspiring as they hoped that it would be.
Well, but again, you write about a female Malaysian medic.
That's right.
Yeah, who tweets, what did she tweet?
She said, I've got my stethoscope and my Kalashnikov, what more could I have?
Yeah.
But what's also interesting about her case is she also reported that she was having difficulty doing her job as a single woman, so she got married, because that gave her greater mobility so that she could do her job. So that's quite interesting there. See, the difficulty we also have is we only have the voices of those who are able and willing to tweet or get involved in social media and willing to blog. And those women, of course, want to present a particular kind of message. And so it's quite difficult to ascertain, you know, how much can we generalize from possibly only about a dozen sources to what we think to be about 200 women.
Catherine Brown, this has been your research, finding out about this world. Do you ever wonder that in reporting on it, I mean, it's incredibly eye-opening, but do you worry about that you might actually be advertising it?
I do. And what's interesting is I've actually been studying this for over 5 years now, looking at women's involvement in political violence generally and within Muslim communities. So it is interesting that now, because of the high-profile cases, that we're seeing an interest in it. But I think it's important just to stress that these young women have a degree of reason and rationality about their choices. They're not just doing it of an emotional whim. There's politics behind it. They're engaged and thinking about politics. And that's really interesting. And understanding that side, as well as the personal reasons that they have, can tell us a whole lot more about how terrorist organizations function and the ways in which they operate. And I think that's probably worth the trade-off that it's giving it some kind of media hype.
Catherine Brown, lecturer in the Defense Studies Department at King's College London. Professor Brown, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you ever so much.
And it has not been a great week for McDonald's. The world's largest restaurant chain posted a 30% drop in quarterly profits, and U.S. sales slumped for the fourth straight quarter. Meanwhile, Bloomberg News reported that menu prices have increased 3% in the last year at McDonald's, and some customers are now turning to rival chains that aren't even in the same category as McDonald's, places like Chili's and IHOP. Michael Regan of Bloomberg News joins us now to talk more about this. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us first about these price increases. What is behind them?
Well, for one thing, a lot of their main ingredients have seen some pretty steep price increases. Cattle futures, for example, are up almost 30% in the last year. Generic cheese future prices are up about the same. And there's also a lot of pressure on wages at that lower end. So really their margins or their profit margins are coming under some pretty tense pressure from costs, as well as this sort of flat to down sales that they've experienced in the last few quarters.
And what's being passed along to consumers is in some cases just a few cents for an item, but I guess that's enough to turn some customers away.
It is. And, you know, as you said, there's other chains that are really sort of, you know, bringing, especially at lunchtime, bringing prices down in an effort to compete with fast food. Chili's, for example, sells a combo meal. You can get a quesadilla, fries and soup or salad for $7, a double cheeseburger with soup or salad for $8. So that's really, you know, entering the sort of the same zone that McDonald's is in right there. And, you know, a lot of people might believe they're getting better quality at a place like that, too.
But they're going to have to pay more probably when all is said and done, especially if you think about things like the tip, than if they were to go to McDonald's.
That's true. That's true, of course.
But that's enough for them. You know, it brings up another question, which is whether people are just more interested in having something that they consider to be maybe healthier or fresher than what they're going to get at McDonald's?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part of the problem. And the analysts will tell you that, too. You know, it was, the big competition for McDonald's and really all the fast foods, the real success story over the last decade has been Chipotle, which, you know, advertises itself as this fresh, you know, more natural type of product. And, you know, don't forget McDonald's owned Chipotle and spun it off several years ago. So, but industry-wide restaurant sales are sort of struggling. They've been up less than 1% for the last 2 years. And there's really a lot of different trends hitting them at once. You know, people have gotten a lot more health conscious. There's also sort of this trend of being more gourmet in America. You know, all the cooking shows, the Iron Chef and whatnot have really, you know, sort of inspired a lot of people to cook at home more. So that's part of it, too.
And McDonald's has made some changes to its menu to try to keep up with this. We also know that the dollar menu, which isn't even the dollar menu anymore, now it's the dollar menu and more, because a lot of the items don't cost a dollar. They cost more than a dollar. But are there other reasons that McDonald's specifically is struggling aside from food costs?
Well, there, for one thing, you know, there's been minimum wage increases in Minnesota, California, and Michigan. And there's a sort of a concerted effort to unionize McDonald's employees. McDonald's would like to be viewed as a collection of small businesses. You know, most of their restaurants are owned by franchises. And, you know, they provide the supplies and everything and the corporate banner. But, you know, they say if you're going to collectively bargain with McDonald's, McDonald's. You have to do it through the franchise owners. And the National Labor Relations Board has come out and said, no, you should have to be able to negotiate with the corporation as well. So there is this sort of strong pressure to increase the wages of McDonald's employees.
Michael Regan of Bloomberg News talking with us about McDonald's. And when we asked the CEO last year about the CEO of Chipotle, that is, about minimum wage, he says, look, we're giving people the opportunity to grow. They can become managers and make a whole lot more. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And it's being described as the first use of chemical weapons by ISIS on the battlefield. Iraqi officials said today that more than 36 troops were hurt in a chlorine gas attack north of Baghdad last month. They were treated and released from the hospital. Meantime, on the other front in the fight against ISIS, there were more U.S. airstrikes in Syria today. The U.S. strategy there includes recruiting and training Syrians to join the fight against ISIS. But senior American military officials believe it will be difficult for Syrian opposition forces to defeat the militants without the help of U.S. combat troops. And President Obama has said that option is off the table. Washington Post senior correspondent Rajiv Chandrasekaran is following this story. And Rajiv, you report something pretty shocking, that Syrian opposition fighters will be trained just to defend territory rather than to seize it back from ISIS.
Yeah, that was pretty shocking to me. But it is in keeping with lessons we've learned from trying to build security forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the early years in those wars, if you'll remember, we tried to build armies in those countries, and we trained them up, and then we sent them into battle on their own. And in many cases, those units crumbled because they didn't have American advisors to steel them in the heat of battle. They didn't have the ability to summon in close airstrikes to help save them or medical evacuation helicopters. And so this has become now understood wisdom in the Pentagon. And so with the president's prohibition on U.S. ground forces, especially in Syria, the military commanders involved in this effort recognize that they simply can't train these folks and then expect to send them into full-fledged battles with Islamic State militants. So the strategy has shifted to having these individuals, about 5,000 a year, according to the latest U.S. plans for the training, have them go into parts of Syria that are under the control of the Free Syrian Army, under the control of the moderate opposition, and serve as kind of neighborhood watch units. So that may be a little belittling, but they would be armed units protecting communities from Islamic State advances, but they wouldn't be on the ground taking the fight to the militants.
And who are we talking about? Are these people right now that the U.S. would like to train in Syria currently? Or are these people in refugee camps elsewhere? Are these people from other countries that the U.S. would like to go into Syria and fight? Who are they?
That's a really good question. The U.S. military does not want to pull out from Syria Syrians who are already fighting. They worry that that could obviously then lead either the Islamic State forces or the forces loyal to the government of Bashar Assad to gain more ground. So this approach is now going to be focused on Syrians in refugee communities, principally in neighboring Jordan and in Turkey. And so there first has to be a recruitment effort going into Syrian communities in those countries and beyond to try to identify promising candidates and encourage them to go through the training process. Then they would be sent to training camps in Saudi Arabia. There's some negotiations to potentially open up additional camps in Qatar and in Jordan, but for now it's Saudi Arabia. They'd be trained for 8 weeks, and then they would be taken into Syria. A lot of questions there. Will these folks who are recruited be good enough to be part of this fighting force? What will their skills be like after 8 weeks? And then obviously the challenge of getting them back in the country. U.S. officials tell me that they expect the first of those forces to be trained and enter Syria not for at least 6 to 8 months.
Well, the other question is, why would they want to go back into Syria if they've already gotten out?
Well, that's a really good question, and that raises some big doubts about the ability to really recruit competent fighters. It would seem to be that those who want to fight are probably still in Syria fighting, and those who don't want to fight were the ones who left.
Right.
So it's going to involve some arm twisting, and this is where critics of the administration approach say, "Hey, look, if you're not going to provide them with combat advisors when they're in there, and if the U.S. strategy is solely focused on going after the Islamic State and not aimed at militarily toppling the Assad government. A lot of these guys aren't going to want to sign up. They're not going to want to put their necks on the line if we're not going to be there promising to help take care of them.
And that's the big question. Is this all going to lead to President Obama having to decide, or maybe even the next president having to decide, okay, if our goal here is to beat back ISIS, we are going to have to put boots on the ground?
I think, Jeremy, this speaks to a larger point with regard to the Obama administration's strategy in confronting the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Their priority is Iraq, is pushing back Islamic State militants from the parts of Iraq they control, allowing the Iraqi government and its military to regain control of territory in that country. Syria is secondary. Now, they recognize Syria is important because that's where the Islamic State is essentially based and has command and control facilities and whatnot. But the approach here really is they're willing to it seems, tolerate some ambiguity, some questions in the policy on the Syria front because their real priority for now is Iraq.
Hmm.
Now, critics, of course, say that's short-sighted, and even if you were to try to stabilize Iraq, if you don't go after the host problem in Syria, you're going to be doing this all over again.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, you covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You've obviously been covering this very closely. Are the right questions being asked by members of Congress to the officials about the strategy going forward?
Well, you know, one of the things I did yesterday in assembling the story is I went back and read the transcripts of the congressional hearings that involved Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel and senior military officials about a month ago. And there were some good questions, but there were an awful lot of terrible questions. There's not a whole lot of good oversight going on over here right now. This is a pretty major military undertaking. We're flying hundreds of combat sorties over Iraq and Syria, dropping an awful lot of munitions. There's planning going on for potentially a more robust combat advising presence in Iraq. Certainly that has not yet been approved by the president. A lot of moving pieces here. And you have on one side a set of fears that this is leading us down a slippery slope and that we're going to be dragged in despite the president's firmly held desires not to have us involved in another major land war in the Middle East. And you have critics of his who say, on the other hand, by taking these sorts of measures that they feel are not aggressive enough, it really increases the prospects that we're going to have to go in a bigger way at some point in the near future.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, senior correspondent and associate editor at The Washington Post. We've got a link to his story about U.S. strategy in Syria at hereandnow.org. Rajiv, thank you so much for talking with us.
A pleasure, as always.
The second season of the political sitcom Alpha House begins streaming on Amazon tonight. The series revolves around four fictional Republican senators who share a Washington, D.C. townhouse. And it's written and produced by Gary Trudeau, creator of the comic strip Doonesbury. Reporter John Kalish caught up with him during filming, and he has this preview.
Alpha House was one of Amazon Studios' first original productions. Amazon is notoriously tight-lipped about its data harvests, and the producers of Alpha House say they don't know how many people watched the first season. But Gary Trudeau, who's used to working solo on Doonesbury, says he enjoyed working with a production team of more than 100. Trudeau is the creator, writer, and executive producer of Alpha House.
There are people who think of Alpha House as kind of 3D Doonesbury, that it has a lot of similarities in the way it's organized, in the way the stories are braided together, and the extended family. We have up to 26 recurring or regular characters now, which is an awful lot for a sitcom.
Longtime fans of Doonesbury will recognize Trudeau's touch in Alpha House. It has the same astute political humor and stinging satire that has earned the comic strip legions of fans and a Pulitzer Prize. In season two of Alpha House, the daughter of the North Carolina senator, portrayed by John Goodman, has her own reality TV show, The Real Daughters of D.C.
So America is like this awesome house party that's been going for almost 200 years. And it's our generation's responsibility to keep the party going, you know? But me and the other DC daughters are totally totally big tent-ish about it. Because millennials are all about diversity. We don't care whether you're rich or white or educated or thin or too thin or rich. You name it, we don't judge. Because we're what America looks like now.
The send-up of the reality TV show was inspired in part by an actual show starring the daughter of Senator John McCain, who along with Senator Elizabeth Warren makes a cameo appearance in Alpha House's second season. In the sitcom, these fictional senators grapple with such hot-button political issues as NSA spying, voter suppression, and sexual assault in the military. Again, Alpha House creator Gary Trudeau.
It's not quite as topical as we hope it feels, in the sense that it's not perishable. It's not so ephemeral that a few weeks later people are going to completely forget about the issue. They tend to be broader issues and political themes. But we do want to create the sense of freshness, of crackling authenticity.
On the set, Trudeau has developed a reputation as a detail-oriented executive producer. But it's his abilities as a writer that have drawn John Goodman, Wanda Sykes, and others into the Alpha House stable.
This is one of those jobs where you go to work and you can't wait to say the words that the writer has written for you.
Mark Consuelos plays Florida's Cuban-American Senator Andy Guzman. The 43-year-old actor has movie star good looks. His character in Alpha House seduces his wedding planner, and his fiancé busts him for bedding Alpha House's Croatian housekeeper.
I think part of the reason why he does that is because he enjoys weaseling his way out of it. He's pretty slick, oily, I would say, and he's a womanizer.
People think you're the next John Edwards. No campaign wants to be put through that nightmare.
What nightmare? I'm getting married, for God's sake.
But you'll just make it worse if you're busted again. Right now, nobody cares if you're doing your housekeeper. And your housekeeper, she's not an illegal.
She won't be. I'm working on it.
Sex and sexual preferences provide much fodder for the comedy here. The Mormon senator from Nevada seems to be a closeted gay man, and when he spills the beans at a press conference that his lesbian chief of staff is both pregnant and about to marry the lesbian staffer of another Republican senator, emotions fly.
That was perfect. People are already tweeting about the GOP gay wedding. It's a hashtag.
We're not getting married.
Oh?
I gotta call my parents.
Your parents? Why?
Oh, they don't know I'm gay. Or pregnant.
I think there are a lot of TV shows that have heart, where you love the characters. And then there are other TV shows, comedies, that have a lot of bite and edge to them.
Jonathan Alter is a veteran journalist and author of best-selling political histories. He serves as one of the sitcom's executive producers.
Not many shows have both heart and bite. And I think that's true of both Doonesbury and Alpha House. On the show, we take some shots at these Republican senators, but you also find yourself rooting for them.
Gary Trudeau says that a few weeks after season two starts streaming, he'll know if Alpha House gets a go-ahead for a third season. If that happens, he'll continue to put his comic strip Doonesbury on hold, except for Sundays. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish in New York.
From political rivalries to football rivalries now, the University of Michigan Wolverines go up against the Michigan State University Spartans this weekend in a rivalry that goes back decades. And the week before the game is peak prank season. Last year, MSU's Spartan statue was painted gold, aka maize, and blue by rogue Michigan fans. This year, Michigan let its guard down. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Michigan Radio's Kate Wells explains.
Right now, the University of Michigan campus looks like a college brochure. It is fall in Ann Arbor. The leaves are gorgeous. Students are out in the sunshine. And at the center of everything, literally, is the sacred M. It is a big gold letter M inlaid on the campus diag, the school's main artery.
You're not allowed to walk over the block M.
Ross McPherson is a Michigan junior, and like every student here, he knows you do not step on the block M.
Because there's a test called a blue book, and if you step on the M before your first blue book, apparently you're supposed to fail. So people generally avoid it, and you'll see that people won't walk on it.
So because the block M is so sacred, frat guys are supposed to guard it 24 hours a day in the week leading up to the annual Michigan State game. It's called Defend the Diag. But this year, that defense did not start until Thursday, which it turns out was too late. In the dark early hours of Wednesday morning, some Spartan fans swooped in and spray-painted the Block M Spartan green, even going so far as to add the letters S and U after it, so it now read MSU for Michigan State University.
My first thought was like, wow, like it had to be some people with some guts to even come down here and do that in the middle of, you know, our territory here.
Chris McClendon is a sophomore business major, but looking ahead to this Saturday's crucial game, he is not feeling great about Michigan's chances.
I don't know. I don't know. We're not having the best. We're in a season of recovery, you know, of reconstruction. So, we'll see what happens, you know. I'm still saying go blue.
See, it has been a tumultuous fall for football fans in Ann Arbor. The team is 3-4 and struggling. Attendance is down at the usually beloved Big House. That's the football stadium, which can seat 100,000 fans. One Michigan player was left in during a game after he'd clearly been hit hard in the head, and it was later confirmed that he had a concussion. Students have even held rallies on campus calling for change at the top. They want the athletic director, Dave Brandon, to go. Which for Michigan student Ross McPherson goes a long way towards explaining why the Block M was not being guarded.
Absolutely. I think there's less support for the team. You can see that if you look at the student sections, there's plenty of seats that are missing. And you can see that people aren't as enthusiastic about this team.
So Michigan morale is not great right before the big game this Saturday. Meanwhile, just an hour away in East Lansing, Michigan State students are guarding their beloved monument, the statue of Sparty the Spartan, 24 hours a day. Of course, the only thing that really matters is what happens at tomorrow's game. Kickoff is at 3:30. For Here and Now, I'm Kate Wells.
Big Ten football. It reminds me of my hometown in Illinois, Fighting Illini country, of a bumper sticker that said, "I break for all animals except wolverines." Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.